8 years ago, the body of a student was found beaten and bloodied in an off-campus apartment near UNC Chapel Hill. Her killer has never been charged. You are listening to Cold Brew, a true crime podcast fueled by Cold Brew Coffee. I'm your host, Caitlin Brewer, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. You can find me on social media at Cold Brew Crime to see images related to this episode. Hello, it's me. I am here again with episode 8. I hope this episode finds you much better than the last one. Personally, I'm a little bit more stressed this time around, but that's okay. I feel like I'm always apologizing for my delay in episode releases, and of course, I wish I could be quicker, but you know, at the end of the day, I'm doing this for free, and this is a really busy season of life for me and for my family, and that's just that. There's really nothing else to say about it. In the last few weeks, we have shipped my car back to North Carolina, and on top of that, we've had to show our rental unit that we live in currently like 25 times. Thankfully, we found a new tenant to rent it after us. So keeping your house clean every day with your toddler is exhausting. The past few days specifically, we've been prepping for the movers that come in approximately 2 days. And honestly, life is just chaos. Like, if I could explain what my bedroom looks like, which is where I'm recording, there's no words at all. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. I will be so relieved once our furniture is picked up and all I have to keep up with is my 2-year-old and some luggage and my sanity. I do want to say a massive thank you to everyone who ordered a t-shirt. It really meant the world to me. If I reached out to you for your address, like literally today, they ship today, so you should have it, I'm pretty sure, by like Saturday or at least Monday. And the rest of you are lucky enough to get your shirts delivered in person. So if you missed the shirt order, that's probably because you don't follow me on social media, and you should. So go follow at Cold Brew Crime on Instagram or Facebook so you don't miss the next round of shirts. Oh, and don't forget about the giveaway still going on. One lucky winner will receive a free Cold Brew True Crime t-shirt and a sticker. To be entered, just leave me a written review on Apple Podcast, and I will be announcing the winner on episode 10. All right, now on to the coffee. All right, y'all, I gotta be honest. I had this whole thing typed up. It was so beautiful about the cold brew that I intended on drinking for this episode. Because to be honest, I started typing this episode up like 2 weeks ago, I know. But I'm actually recording this episode at what is now 9:12 p.m. and it has been an extra long day. And you know what I'm drinking? A PBR hard coffee. Yes, that exists, and yes, I had one chilling in my fridge. It actually tastes exactly like a Yoo-hoo. If that's your thing, go give these bad boys a whirl. It is really retro looking. You know, I really don't have that much negative stuff to say about them. They're 5% alcohol, and really, they're quite delightful. I know there's no way I could drink more than two of these, like, consecutively, because they are pretty sweet. So, shout out to PBR, and the dear souls who left a case of these at our house 3 weeks ago. That's that. Okay, I'll be right back to share the case after this. So this is one of those cases that when I started researching what cases I wanted to cover on the podcast months ago, like April, this one always popped up. It's on the North Carolina SBI website, so it still gets a decent amount of exposure, and it's everywhere I look. Pretty much if you Google North Carolina cold cases, every article will have this. You know, this one should be there because it is unsolved. I almost covered it on one of the first episodes, and then changed my mind after like a week of researching because something just wasn't clicking. Like, I don't know. I was not engaged. So when I started researching again this past month, I realized that September, the month it is as I record, is the anniversary month of this young girl's death. And it just seems like it was meant for me to share her story in the month of December. I really get chills talking about this. I'm just certain that this wasn't an accident, and with this being a fairly recent crime, I really hope that this can bring some exposure to this victim's story. I hope I do it justice. Like I mentioned earlier, this case takes us to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, hashtag Go Tar Heels, hashtag Duke Sucks. If you know, you know. Am I right? If you're somehow not familiar with Chapel Hill or the university, for whatever reason, I'll just give you a quick debrief about it. Chapel Hill is in the Piedmont region of North Carolina, so it's pretty much right in the center of the state. The town actually stretches across three counties, Orange, Chatham, and Durham. And in the 2010 census, which how crazy is it that we are now in the 2020 census? Like, we're about to have new, whatever, population numbers. Chapel Hill had a population of 57,000. It houses a lot of historical buildings, and although being the 15th largest city in North Carolina, personally, I feel like Chapel Hill still puts off a small town, like small hometown vibe. The University of North Carolina was founded in 1789 and is one of the oldest universities in the U.S. The university is obviously a huge part of the town and its history, and I think that's really obvious as soon as you step foot on the campus. And, you know, just visit the area in general, you can tell the community takes a lot of pride in the school and the students that go there. The campus has really done its best to preserve old buildings and keeping the traditional aesthetics of the campus alive, but as you can imagine, it's really hard to contain an ever-growing college town. Housing continues to be built along with more retail shops and restaurants, and the culture surrounding the town and the campus really continue to evolve with each passing school year. With that being said, some of the locations discussed in this case are no longer present, or they go by a new name. I've not been to Chapel Hill since like 2014, so although I've done my best to research the name changes of certain locations and what's open and what's not, I will be referring to these locations by their previous names. Okay, so it's September in 2012. It's Labor Day weekend, and a student is found dead in her off-campus apartment. That student was Faith Hedgepeth. Faith was born on September 26, 1992, and was beginning her fourth semester at UNC. She had taken the previous semester off, but stayed in Chapel Hill to work, and she had returned to classes for the fall semester and was technically beginning her junior year. Faith was a member of the, I'll try to pronounce this right, Haliwa Saponi Native American tribe. Sure, I messed that up. Which was state recognized as a Native American tribe. She grew up in Hollister, North Carolina, which kind of borders Virginia and was only about an hour and a half from Chapel Hill. In high school, Faith was an honor student, a cheerleader, part of tons of extracurricular activities, and she was really just determined to be a part of whatever she could. She was smart. She was beautiful. Her smile is just like radiant in every picture you see of her. She ended up earning the Gates Millennium Scholarship, which is funded by the Bill Gates himself. And she immediately knew without a doubt that she wanted to attend UNC Chapel Hill. She hoped to be the first person in her family to graduate from college, and she was considering becoming a pediatrician or a teacher. And like I said, she was beautiful. Like in every photo, her smile is just unforgettable and bright. And in this news article about her case, one of her family members said she was always the happy person in the room. Like, you know, that one family member that when they're not at that family gathering, there's just something missing. She was that person to her family. She can make anyone smile. She had a super fun and bubbly personality. And in one documentary I watched, a family member you know, described her again as the person who could ease the tension, whether it be family drama or whatever. Faith knew how to get everybody back on the same page. Faith had been living in an off-campus apartment at a complex called Hawthorne at the View. It was about 15 minutes from campus and was located between Chapel Hill and Durham. The apartment complex is now called, or was recently called, Nova. That's what it looked like on Google, so I can't verify that. When I went to Google map the apartment, I was shocked, actually, because the Google camera car, you know, that little guy that drives around, actually went all the way back into the apartment complex. So you could virtually see the exact apartment where this crime occurred. Faith's apartment was in the very last building within the complex, kind of like back in the woods a little bit. It was apartment 1502, which would be building 1500 and apartment number 2 on the top level of the two-story building. Faith lived with her friend Karina Rosario. It was actually Karina's apartment, and Faith had been kind of staying with her. They had been friends since freshman year, and Faith was apparently going to move into her own apartment at the end of September once her financial aid kicked in. At some point, Karina's boyfriend Eric also lived in the apartment with them, or at least stayed there enough that the neighbors assumed he lived there. I do need to note real quick that the relationship between Karina and Eric was reportedly abusive, and when he moved out, it was not on good terms. In July of 2012, he attempted to break into the girl's apartment twice. Faith convinced Karina at that point to get a protective order that required Eric to stay away from the apartment, and that created a lot of resentment between Faith and Eric. Eric believed that it was Faith's influence over Karina that had led the two to separate. In court documents, someone stated they actually heard Eric threaten to kill Faith if he couldn't get back with Karina. So, like, dude, you need to chill. Okay, now let me recount kind of the series of events for you. Like I said, it's the beginning of Labor Day weekend. It's Thursday evening, September 6, 2012. And Faith had gone to a rush event for a campus sorority, which she was interested in joining. If you don't know what that is, it's kind of like a meet and greet type thing to get to know one another. And she left there at 7:15. She said she had a paper to work on. She and her roommate Karina had actually gone to a library on campus to study. And while there, she sent some texts back and forth with her father mentioning how she hoped to join the sorority. And the two left the library around 11:30. So by midnight, they were going to go out to, like, they got home and they decided to go out to a local nightclub in downtown Chapel Hill called The Thrill. This location has changed hands like half a dozen times, like literally on Google Maps over the years of street images. The name is never the same. There's construction almost every other photo and it's just never ending. So in the last image in June 2019, it actually shows a for sale sign, and I haven't been able to find anything stating what it currently is. So the property is no longer on the market, but again, I cannot find what the property is today in present time. The Thrill allowed customers under the age of 21 to come in just for dancing. So, you know, that's pretty common in a college town. They just X your hands so you don't get caught with a drink, and that's that. So the security cameras show the girls leaving The Thrill at 2:06 a.m. And that video footage is the last visual record of Faith before her death. So the girls make it back to the apartment around 3 a.m. But, like, really, could you remember willingly staying up till 3 a.m.? That's so crazy, and I definitely used to do it. So, anyways, a woman who lived below the girls was actually awake. Again, I cannot process willingly being awake at 3 a.m. But this lady told the police that she heard three thumping noises in the apartment above her, which would have been Karina's and Faith's. And she described it as a heavy bag, like, being dropped, or furniture possibly being flipped over, like a chair falling over. According to the police timeline, shortly after these noises, Faith's Facebook was accessed. At 3:40 a.m., A text was sent from Faith's phone to another former boyfriend of Karina's named Brandon Edwards. It said, quote, "Hey B, can you come over here, please? Rosario needs you more, aha, you know. Please let her know you care," end quote. Then a text 3 minutes later with a single word, quote, "than," period, end quote, which could be a correction for the aha. So if that's the case, then the text should have read, quote, "Hey B, can you come over here, please? Rosario needs you more than, you know, please let her know you care," end quote. And then at 4:16, Brandon sent a return text asking who sent the previous text, meaning he was not familiar with Faith's phone number and that this probably was weird for him to receive this text message at 4 a.m. Karina's phone records also show that she had been trying to call Brandon around the same time, but he never answered. So she ended up calling Jordan McCrary, who was a soccer player for Chapel Hill. At 4:25, Karina ended up leaving the apartment to get in the car with Jordan, who had come to pick her up. And Karina said later in her statement that when she left, Faith was asleep and she left the door unlocked. I don't know why. I do not understand this. Why did you knowingly leave the door unlocked with your sleeping roommate inside? Like, did y'all not have a key? Was this like a thing you did? I don't understand. Still, I don't understand. So this Jordan guy literally picks her up at 4:30 a.m. just to drop her off somewhere else. And then she stays at that friend's house all through, you know, the next morning. And then at 10:30 a.m., she gets a hold of their friend, her and Faith's friend Marisol, to come pick her up and take her back to the apartment. Apparently this was like a pretty common thing they did. I don't know. There's just a lot of like favors to ask of people, in my opinion. So I watched an episode of Breaking Homicide. I know I've mentioned this show before, but they really cover some good cases. It's on the ID channel on Hulu. And Marisol was actually interviewed on this TV show. And she said that Karina called her needing a ride and that they just kind of made a plan together to go back to the apartment, pick up Faith, and Marisol was going to drop them all off on campus. Marisol said she often gave them both rides. Like, I think it was a very regular thing. They would stop and get breakfast before going to campus. So this scenario for these three was not strange and was very common. Karina and Marisol arrive back to the apartment around 11 a.m. They enter the apartment and start calling out for Faith, but they get no reply. And from my understanding, this was just a one-bedroom apartment, so it wasn't like Faith wouldn't be able to hear them unless she had on headphones or something. So the two girls enter the bedroom to find Faith's lifeless body, bloodied, hanging off the bed, the only clothing being a shirt that was pulled up over her face, and just blood everywhere. Karina immediately dials 911, and before I go too far into the 911 call, I want to just explain the crime scene in more detail. Details of this case were kept really quiet, like sealed, signed, delivered to no one. The town quickly got a court order to seal all records as they were collected. And over the years, more information about what was found at the scene has been released, but I still think there's stuff we don't really know. There's a few, because I mean, it's unsolved still. Like, it's shocking that we even know this much. There are a few key pieces of evidence to note. And the first thing is the police did find DNA from several people inside the apartment, which really does make sense because several people normally frequented the apartment. Like, it's a college apartment. You have people over to study, you have friends, you have sleepovers. You, like, that's not shocking that there was a lot of DNA. But they were able to create a specific male DNA profile from bodily fluids, if you know what I mean, found near the body and matched with DNA found elsewhere in the apartment. So there was a specific body fluid from a male by Faith's body. One of the other items found near the body on the bed was a used tampon. And this led investigators to believe a sexual assault may have occurred, but the autopsy would later show no signs of a sexual assault. The autopsy would show, though, that Faith did die from blunt force trauma to the head. And found in the room was a very bloody Bacardi rum bottle. So in the show Breaking Homicide, again, they had a lot of good info. They actually do a simulation to see if being hit in the head with a rum bottle could kill someone. Obviously, it's on a dummy. But they even, measured the force that it would need to be to kill. And they did confirm that being hit over the head with a rum bottle, specifically like the one found in Faith's room, would be enough to kill someone, even with fairly minimal force. So far we have DNA, used tampon, Bacardi rum bottle, and another item found near the body was a handwritten note that said, in all caps, first line, I'm not stupid, second line, bitch, third line, jealous. In all caps, I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous. So it was written with a ballpoint pen. It appeared to be written on a torn off bottom of a fast food bag. The text was sloppy and looked aggressive. Police have not said officially if they got the note analyzed. I'm sure they did. But several other outlets have and have released those findings. So some things that the expert handwriting analysis people found, the note was completely clean of blood. Not a speck of blood on the note. How? How is that possible? There was blood spattered all over the room. This suggests that the note could have been written away from the crime scene and then basically delicately placed on the crime scene. It also appeared that the writer tried to disguise their handwriting by using their non-dominant hand. There was also discussion that the word stupid, specifically, could have even been written by someone other than the main writer, because it just looks more precise. Another logical point that Tom Gasparoli, and I'll explain him in a minute, made was, why was the note even there? If it was for Faith to see, she's dead. That does not make sense. And if it was left by the killer or killers, then that's dumb. This is a very incriminating piece of evidence. What if you had written on something else in the apartment and they put two and two together? This is just carelessness. So the note could have possibly been left as a red herring, which is, something that is purposely placed by the killer in order to distract or mislead investigators. But again, it is a very telling piece of evidence. So all in all, this note really is just random and a little weird. All right, back to Tom. Tom Gasparoli is an excellent TV journalist and newspaper columnist for The News and Observer out of Raleigh. And he really dedicated a lot of his time researching and investigating Faith's case. I give him a lot of props. He blogged about the case for years right after it happened. And then recently, he compiled all his research and put it into a podcast. The podcast is called Pursuit. And if you want to hear interviews with people related to Faith's case, I highly recommend listening. Okay, now let's discuss this 911 call real quick. I am not personally going to play the recording of the 911 call because 911 calls kind of freak me out. But it is on YouTube if you'd like to listen to it yourself. As I mentioned before, Faith's roommate Karina Rosario made the 911 call. And after the dispatcher answered, Karina replied, quote, "Hi, I just walked into my apartment and my friend is semi-unconscious," end quote. And the first thing to point out right here is that Karina said hi. She paused and then said, like she needed a moment to process her thought. And I'm just saying, if I'm calling 911 after walking in on my roommate and friend, good friend, that has lain in the bed just bloody and unconscious, I just don't think I would be saying hi. I would be really frazzled and like really hard to understand and just like yelling, send help, personally. So, but again, I am not trying to overanalyze her. I understand everyone reacts to trauma differently. As the call continues, though, the dispatcher asks Karina to do a few things, like check to see if Faith is breathing, touch her, Faith, to see if she's warm or cold, and to remove any pillows that might be like behind her back, making, you know, maybe it hard to breathe or something. Karina does not do any of this. She basically doesn't even move. Like, she just says, like, I can't touch her, basically. Which, I mean, I could kind of understand, because it is a pretty aggressive scene. But also, if it's someone you really care about, wouldn't you want to do whatever you could to help them in that moment? But again, everyone reacts differently. So then, there's another thing. Tom mentioned this on his podcast, and it was that Karina never said Faith's name. During the whole 7 minutes and 51 seconds of this call, she never says Faith. And that's just kind of odd. Like, she just kept saying, my friend, and never her name. Karina was also not alone when she found the body. Like I said, Marisol had driven Karina to the apartment and they both entered together. But even when the 911 dispatcher told Karina not to hang up so she wasn't alone, like while waiting for the police, Karina like didn't say anything. She wasn't like, oh, Marisol's like my other friend's here with me. I don't know. You don't hear anybody in the background. It's total silence. And it's just, I don't know. It's just really kind of strange. If you've listened to other 911 calls, like go listen to this one. And it just seems off. I've said it 3 times before, but I'm saying it again. I understand everyone reacts differently to trauma, and I'm not trying to be too judgy, but it is still a little off. So I'll just leave that there. Okay, we've got DNA left at the scene, the note, the rum bottle, the 911 call, and then a friend of Faith's comes forward. She has a voicemail on her phone that was left by Faith on the night of her death. It seemed to be a pocket dial. And I'm going to play a real quick clip. It's real quick. Just so you can understand, like, the level of noise in this voicemail. Okay, so I'm sorry if that sound quality was awful, but the voicemail sound quality actually was awful. So the voicemail seems to be picking up a conversation between 3 people and recorded for like 3 minutes, which I think is the maximum time for a voicemail. Faith's father confirmed that he does hear Faith's voice in the voicemail. And I mean, that's pretty hard to argue with. The other 2 voices appear to be a male and a female. And the voicemail is timestamped at 1:23 a.m., which is when Faith would have been at the Thrill, the nightclub. So for the majority of the voicemail, it's pretty inaudible. Like, you know, there had to be some type of audio enhancement to really even comprehend the words. An audio expert, Arlo West, did analyze the recording, and he claims that he hears Faith crying out for help, and like a male says, I think she's dying, and then a female replies, do it anyways. It appears that the people in the voicemail are angry. And Faith's father claims he hears her specifically yell, help. Arlo, audio dude, also believes he hears the name Rosie mentioned, which was a nickname for Karina, because her last name is Rosario. Faith's father believes that this voicemail was recorded during Faith's death, and Arlo West actually does agree. However, Chapel Hill police disagree and believe that it was recorded at the nightclub. Apparently, there's some uncertainty in the timestamp, whether or not it was correct, and that There was not club music in the background. The voicemail did not appear to be too valuable to the police. Faith was actually only 5 months older than me, and in September of 2012, I, just like Faith, was beginning a new school year. I was starting my sophomore year at UNC Asheville, and my best friend was actually starting her sophomore year at UNC Chapel Hill. She was living on campus at the time of Faith's death, and I asked her to, you know, share some thoughts with me and what she remembered about that time. So I think the fact that both of us are so close in age to Faith, it makes this case just a little more sensitive to both of us, since we can really, like, put ourselves in the victim's, her life at that time. We were doing those same kind of things. My friend recalls just like a super eerie feeling on campus. And with the legacy of Eve Carson's murder back in 2008, there was an overall uneasy feeling all around. Eve was the student body president who had been shot after being kidnapped by two men who, like, wanted her money. That's just kind of what everybody also had in the back of their minds. So at this point, no one knew if it was a serial killer or if the killer was just walking around on campus acting like nothing was wrong. All these thoughts go through your head when a crime like that happens so close to where you live and where you go to the store and where you walk by. Like, you just start thinking crazy things. My friend also said that students did receive an alert from the chancellor by like 5 p.m. on the 7th. And it had information just kind of like announcing the death and offering grief counselors to students that may need them. My friend also noted that the scholarship Faith had received was really prestigious and a really big deal, pretty much to anybody that knew the school or applied to go to that school knew about this scholarship. So I also asked her if Faith's death, like, came back up later in the year or if it kind of just, like, disappeared in everybody's mind. And she said that the Daily Tar Heel did continue to post about Faith's case, but that Eve's death was one that stuck out to her more. And it was probably because it had closure. You can't really talk that much about an open case because there's not that much information out for the public. I personally don't remember hearing about Faith's murder while I was at UNC Asheville, but I also don't watch the news and definitely did not at that time as I was also walking around campus by myself. Okay, so who were the suspects? Who are the suspects? I think just from me stating the evidence, we have all already made our own assumptions. So at the beginning, Eric Tekoi Jones was a strong suspect. Once the police learned, you know, his history of domestic violence and such, he obviously did not like Faith, so he was pretty high on the totem pole. Apparently, the night before, around 6 p.m., he actually texted someone asking for forgiveness for, quote, "for what I am about to do," unquote. He also, I think, posted that on his Twitter feed. So, like, that's sketchy all around. The police did request a DNA sample from Jones, and he did agree. His DNA did not match the sample from the apartment, and he was no longer considered a suspect after that. They did retrieve many other samples of DNA from Brandon Edwards and a few other men that had been at the nightclub that night. They were all eventually excluded. Over time, there has been a lot of controversy over how Chapel Hill handled the crime scene and if proper steps were taken. According to a neighbor that had been there that morning, she said the police really did not secure the scene accordingly and actually didn't even search further than the apartment. They didn't check the woods, they didn't check surrounding apartments. The neighbor said the police never went around to talk to neighbors, never knocked on any doors to ask questions, and they also did not secure Faith's car as part of the crime scene while they searched the apartments. The SBI did take over in late 2013, and it was clear that several steps had been missed while under Chapel Hill's investigation. So now what about Karina? Was she ever considered a suspect? I really could not find any sources that said she was ever highly considered by the police as a suspect. The police have still never actually named a suspect or person of interest, so That's not cool. Karina apparently was interviewed for a long time the day Faith was found, and the current Chapel Hill police chief says that Karina has been cooperative with them and they are still in contact with her. However, Karina has never spoken to the press. Not a single time, ever. Shortly after Faith's death, Karina moved back to her hometown in New Jersey, and as far as we know, that's where she is today. On an episode of 2020, in September of 2016, the Chapel Hill police actually released an image that was generated by Parabon Nano Labs, which is a genetic testing company, and the image was what the suspect who left the bodily fluids by Faith's body might look like, based solely on phenotype, you know, in his DNA profile. The program Parabon used predicts eye color, hair color, skin color, freckling, face morphology, and ancestry. According to the image, the suspect was very strongly Native American and European mixed or Latino. Most of his genetic markers point to Mexican or Colombian ancestry, and some South American and African countries making up the full balance. Parabon believed with over 80% confidence that the suspect would have a skin tone in the olive range with very few freckles and black hair. So what could have happened to Faith on that September night? Chapel Hill police have stated they do not believe it was a crime of opportunity by a stranger, but that it was someone in Faith's social group. Tom Gasparoli believes that the killer was just outside Faith's closest friends and acquaintances. There's a good chance this person didn't actually know Faith, but could have been acting out of anger at some grievance she caused to someone close to them. Several people, in my opinion, seem suspicious, and whether they personally committed the murder, I believe they could have arranged it and tried to help cover it. Someone out there knows what happened to Faith, and they won't be able to keep it a secret forever. If you have information about this case, call the Chapel Hill Police Department at 919-969-2001 or the NC State Bureau of Investigation at 800-334-3000. A $40,000 reward is available for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for the murder of Faith Hedgepeth. Cold Brew is recorded, edited, and produced by me. To be sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe to Cold Brew True Crime Podcasts wherever you listen. And don't forget to enter the giveaway. All you need to do is leave me a written review on Apple Podcasts. I'll be announcing the winner on episode 10. You can send any questions or comments about this episode to me on social media at Cold Brew Crime. And be sure to follow me for updates about my upcoming move and the next episode release. Thank you so much for listening.